anyway, he didn't have to.
You don't watch TV that much, do you?
But I make no complaints about it. I think that in press conferences, which we hold as often as we can, sometimes two or three times a day, we subject ourselves to the kinds of questions, testing our positions by members of the press that Mr. Nixon doesn't get tested on. Condescends to hold a press conference once every 8 days. I haven't seen him labeled in the press for not holding him more frequently. I don't know why. And so he doesn't get the exposure to this cross-examination that we get and that we don't present. I like it. It creates news, gives us a chance to get out our views. But he's conducting his campaign on the basis that, well, it doesn't matter what he says. He's riding the crest of a tidal wave into shore. So he doesn't have to have a rudder or a motor. All he has to do is ride. And I haven't seen him belabor, taking this aloof attitude, this condescending attitude that the American people will vote for him without really knowing what he stands for. I suggest that the press might belabor him on this, but that's the question. You know, Eric Severide said once years ago, the free press doesn't mean that the press is always right or fair. The free press means only that somehow the truth emerges out of all the weaknesses and shortcomings of the human beings who run our news media, weaknesses and shortcomings that we in politics also share.
Is the truth emerging? I'm sorry, is the truth emerging?
We'll know better on November 6th.
Senator, in the beginning, Humphrey was regarded as an easy win. Then suddenly, his popularity support seemed to take a plunge. Well, what do you feel happened?
Well, I think that the assassination of Senator Kennedy changed the picture with respect to a lot of people, including his
Humphrey. Well, even after the Kennedy assassination, there was still a feeling that Humphrey would win. Why do you say?
Well, that's when the problems began, and I think the convention problem. Well, I don't know what else there would be, because the division, and perhaps it was an illusion at any point over the summer that he was the obvious winner. I don't think he's the obvious winner in this election even now. And polls show that 57% to 61% of Americans now don't want Mr. Nixon to be president. And that is because they don't know him. They know him pretty well. It's probably because they know him.
This must be a question that maybe not any politician would want to answer, but if he should lose on November 5th, to whom will the task fall to rebuild the Democratic Party? Around whom will Democrats gather? Will it be Mr. Humphrey or will it be Mr. Johnson? Somebody's going to rebuild and revitalize this party.
Well, nobody really knows who knew when Adlai Stevenson lost in 1960 John F. Kennedy. Leadership and ideas and life and victory and success. New leaders emerge, and this is what happens. I have no prediction as to who the Democratic candidate in 1972 would be if we did go in on November 5th.
I don't mean so much the Democratic candidate, Mr. Muskie. I mean a man to whom people go for counsel, a man whom the top Democrats will gather around.
Well, there'll probably be many, just as there are now.
But Mr. Johnson, what do you think about him? Will he be out of the picture?
WFIL taping October 9.
In tribute to the ideas given to the moviegoer and constant TV watcher, is there truth in this, and do you believe this physical violence on TV and on the screen should be reduced?
You've asked one of the toughest questions that faces our society, Joel. We believe in a free press, and this means not only the newspapers, of course, but television and radio. And the difficulty with television is that it is involved and caught up so often in spot news coverage. And
has to film things as they happen or it doesn't film them. And when you have live coverage of a thing like Chicago, for example, you have to make rather rapid, on-the-spot decisions about what news to cover. And no chance to develop a perspective on how you present it in a balanced way. Now, you're speaking about something more than that, of course. You're talking also about news, about violence that's reported in the news broadcasts, the news telecasts.
Well, not only news broadcasts, but also the...
program.
The created violence or the violence written into normal TV shows and movies, things like that also.
I think there could be a better balance here, yes. I do, because people are influenced. I think it's going to take some pretty objective and in-depth evaluations by people trained to do that sort of thing to give us a hard reading on the connection between violence in stories on television and their impact upon people. Certainly there's enough evidence to create concern, and we've got a tough problem to work out to maintain a free press, a free communications media, but while at the same time exercising the kind of restraint that would give us a balanced program. You know, a word that we're forgetting, Joel, in 1968 America, is that you get discipline and order not only by imposed restraints, that is, by police power, but in a free society, the best restraint is self-restraint. And I think that we all need to practice self-restraint, including those people who put together television programs. They ought to begin to think themselves of the impact of what they're showing upon the psychology of the country and upon particular people, particular groups of people. And I think that perhaps as they look at it, they'll come to realize that they can do better in this regard.
From West Philadelphia Catholic Girls, Denise Small. Denise.
Senator Muskie, some news commentators and some political analysis have called the United Nations a weak union or a weak group. Could you possibly tell me how, under your administration, there would be a or stronger United Nations? How would the United States try to build up the United Nations? And would you also agree to making each nation support its own, their own problems in the United Nations and pay their own way?
Well, the United Nations can't be made strong by any one country. We've given it, I think, our support. We've strongly supported the idea of an international forum of this kind, and we'd like to see it enlarge its peacekeeping functions, as well as the many service functions which it now performs, and in addition to serving as a pure forum. As a pure forum, it has value. It's a place where countries can talk out their differences, even if they don't resolve them. It's valuable. But to make it strong, to make it really effective as a peacekeeping forum, all of the countries must agree on that as an objective, which then comes down to what each country regards as in its own best interests. There are countries which have regarded the United Nations as a place for propaganda, as a place to initiate divisive moves which divide countries of the world. It's very much, although the parallel I don't think ought to be relied upon too heavily, very much like our experience following the war for independence, when for 5 or 6 years we tried to operate under the Articles of Confederation. You recall that they were inadequate to keep the peace in our own country. And so we were able to, the founders were able to develop a new constitution which created more effective authority and a better means for the states to work together. Well, I hope that the UN will eventually evolve in that direction. But we've had discouraging setbacks. It has had successes, but it has not had success in really inhibiting the major powers when they regard their own self-interests as an objective which cannot be served through the United Nations.
Ms. Leslie, Cynthia Leslie, you opened up this unrehearsed news conference here with the young people, and Senator Muskie, I'm sure you have something now to pursue the senator with.
Thank you. Senator Muskie, how will the Democratic Party try to capture the confidence and ultimately the vote of the disenchanted black man and the college student?
Well, I think the process that we've got to undergo is the same kind of process that you try to engage in when as individuals, you try to instill confidence in some other individual. in your purposes and in your motives. All you can do is to discuss the problems in which you have a mutual interest, discuss your approaches to those problems, illuminate them with your own record, if you have one, which everyone who's running for president or vice president in this campaign has, and hope that out of everything that the voter can learn about you, about the kind of person you are, about the kind of character you have, about what you stand for and represent, what you're willing to fight for, whether or not you're the kind of person they can trust. I mean, trust isn't a tangible thing that you can package and distribute. It has to be built out of intangible things that bind people together or divide them. And this is why, of course, even in the days of television and radio, candidates go out among the people. I don't know of any better way than exposure, direct exposure, and real exposure, and listening, that you can establish this quality which I think is the most valuable thing in a free society.
Joe Gibbs, you've been raising your hand there and kind of pawing the ground like you want to go back. Go ahead.
Senator, yesterday, October 8th, Representative Carl Albert, Democrat from Oklahoma, accused the House Republicans of staging a filibuster to block action on a bill that would clear the way for television debates. Now, the Republicans feel that Nixon doesn't want this bill passed, evidently because of impending embarrassment on Mr. Nixon's part, as happened in the Kennedy-Nixon debates of 1960. Do you think a program such as that might again end in a disaster for Mr. Nixon, now pitted against a man who seems to know the issues very well, Mr. Humphrey?
I think Mr. Nixon's reluctance to get involved is the best answer that I can give to you, Joe. If you were not concerned that the debates might be harmful to his chances, I would assume he'd be willing to engage in them.
Larry?
Senator, in 1964, the Democrats promised a great society, and in keeping with this, after their election, they poured millions of dollars into the ghettos. And yet during that administration, after all this money, we see a Detroit, we see a Watts, we see a Newark. Now, what is it? Is it mismanagement? Or is it the fact that maybe these people are being deluded by this promise of a better society when maybe they can't get it, no matter how much money is poured in?
The actual fact, Larry, is that we began building this great society in the sense that we mean it 180 years ago. We said then that our objective was to create a society in which every individual could achieve fulfillment, would have an equal chance to improve his life. Now, we've moved in that direction and come closer to that objective than any society ever has. But there's still a gap between our performance and the ultimate achievement of that objective. Now, in 1964, even before, but in 1964, in his campaign for election, President Johnson held up the hope of new programs to get us moving even closer to the objective of an equal chance for every member of our society, and he devised a number of imaginative programs to do that job. Now, it's quite true, I think, that the closer people get to that objective, the more impatient they are to close the rest of the gap. I think this is part of our problem. But I think, secondly, that in the 60s we've developed a level of affluence in our country that we never knew before, that for most Americans has meant the highest standard of living we've ever known, with the result that the contrast between the haves and the have-nots is greater than it ever was before. And this has stimulated, I think, unrest. Thirdly, a lot of the programs, especially in the poverty program, that we've undertaken to develop are experimental in nature. They represent new departures in the problem of dealing with the problems of people. Some of them have been successful, like Head Start and Upward Bound. Others have had mixed success. And that's the nature of experiments, as you young people in school know. And of course, then, finally, there's the point that we've not been able to fund a great many of these programs, as we would have liked, because of the war. The war isn't the only problem, because when the war is behind us, there are still going to be people in the Congress who resist this kind of approach to the problem of creating equal opportunity. It will always be a struggle until we finally achieve it. I think we've gone a great way, even in this eight-year period. For instance, there are twice as many black Americans with incomes over $8,000 a year today than there were 8 years ago. The unemployment rate among black Americans has been cut in half in that period. But these are only slight moves, relatively small movements, toward the direction of real equality. And the real equality that they want is something that you can't legislate, although we do have to legislate these programs. The real equality they want is acceptance. Acceptance on the part of other Americans. And the answer to that problem lies in the hearts and minds of other Americans.
I think, Senator, that in your career you'll have to admit you have faced some professional news conferences and with the newspaper or television.
To make of the United States a place where every American has a chance to use his own talents. The unfortunate part of present-day America is that there are millions of Americans living in environments that are beyond their control who do not have an equal chance to advance themselves. I mean, self-help isn't much of a solution unless the environment is such as to make possible some results for those who seek self-help. So you do need to make investments. The private sector has to make investments. The government has to make investments. Head Start, a program I just mentioned, is not a handout program. This is a way to help young people who are brought up in unacceptable environments, environments that give them no hope, help them get a start in education so that they can get into the school system on something like an equal basis with those who come from better environments. Upward Bound is a similar program. In other words, we're trying to create programs that give them a stimulus, which will help them then to use their own talents, create their own lives. We realize, I think at least as much and perhaps more than others, that in a free society, it's the creative energies of the individual which makes life worthwhile for the individual and for society. We don't believe in welfare state.
Cynthia Leslie?
Senator Muskie. Mr. Humphrey has long been a proponent of the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. However, with the military seizure of Czechoslovakia by the Russians, the foreign picture is gone.
To prevent an economic depression at the end of the Vietnam War.
Our economy was booming before the war entered its present phase. We had had three recessions in the 1950s under the 8 years of Republican administration. And when we came into office in 1960, when President Kennedy came into office, we were near the end of one of those recessions. And we moved from that point in an unbroken upward trend of the present state of our economy. And this was true up through 1965. It was by the use of tax policies, a tax cut at that time to generate economic steam, the use of appropriate programs to stimulate economic growth in backward areas, that we stimulated the economy in a time when the war was not on. Now, when this war ends, there are a great many things that we will need to do. We need to do many things in the field of education, for example, that we're not now doing. We need to do many things to clean up the air and the water that we are not now doing. There are plenty of tasks to engage the energies and to stimulate the economy of our country. We don't need war to make America strong economically or to make it prosperous economically. We need
reaction. What do you mean by that?
Yes, I think that his message is one of fear and hatred and division. I think he's trying to stimulate the fears of this country, trying to stimulate the hatred which underlies some of these fears, in order to divide the country. His answer to these social problems is to build a wall between those who have a privileged position in our society and those who do not have. There's no safety and security in that kind of a policy. And yet, strangely enough, a lot of Americans are reacting to it as though this is the way to get safety and security. When you divide a country, you do nothing but build tensions and create the basis for violence which leaves no one safe.
Are more Americans reacting than you ever thought possible to a cause like this? Are you surprised at what apparently is his following?
Well, the thing has grown so that I don't suppose the element of surprise entered into it at any clear-cut point. Looking back perhaps a year, I doubt that I would have guessed a year ago that he would command as much as 20% of the vote, and I think that's what some of the polls show. I think it's a disturbing thing to consider that 20% of Americans would buy this concept of America.
Cut.
million.
Groundbreaking ceremony, October
9. Today, that has never been met by any society in the entire history of man. Because no society has ever solved the problem of making it possible for multitudes of different kinds of people to live together in freedom, in harmony, in dignity, and in justice. And the reason is that as we become crowded, as we become industrialized, we find it necessary to create such giant institutions in industry and in government that they become impersonal. They're so big that the individual citizen and human being feels very insignificant, feels very inadequate, and feels understandably that what he cares about and that his problems are of very little interest to these giant institutions which run his society. And so the great challenge of American life in 1968 is a way to make it possible for the individual citizen to make his voice and his problems felt in the places which determine the shape of his own life. I live in a state far removed from this corner of Philadelphia. Most of my people in Maine have no conception of what it is like to live in a city like this. But let me say to you that all of them understand that what happens here in this community of 60,000 people makes a difference to what happens to them. Because we understand that no society will work, no society will survive unless every member of it believes that he has a chance to improve himself. That unless each member of that society believes that when we mean freedom, we're talking about him. That when we speak of opportunity, we're talking about him. When we talk about decent housing, we're talking about him. That when we talk about decent jobs, we're talking about him. That's what freedom means, if it means anything in any society. And our great challenge in America is to prove to every one of you, every one of the people in my state, that this is indeed what we mean. Now, there's one word that's the key to it all, and I saw it on one of these signs. And to me, it's the most heartwarming political sign that I've seen in this campaign. And it reads, "People trust Humphrey and Muskie." We need trust to make this country work. But trust goes two ways. We ask you to trust us. You have every right to ask us to trust you. And until we've established that kind of communication, that kind of understanding, that kind of trust and confidence, we can't make this country work for any citizen anywhere in it. And so my interest in this campaign is to travel around this country, to mingle with all our people, to try to understand all their problems, to try to develop the best ideas I can get anywhere on what it takes to create trust, to create confidence, to build the basis for an equal chance for everyone, to provide decent jobs, decent housing, decent schools, decent recreational opportunities for all Americans, whoever they are, wherever they are, whatever their origin. I'm interested, of course, in the election on November 5th. But above all, I want to begin building in this 1968 election the basis for a truly free America. And that means an America in which every American is truly free. And so thank you again for welcoming me here. Thank you again for listening to me. And I hope that as the years go on, each of us will have more and more reason to trust the other. Thank you, and God bless you all.
Polish Hall's speech, October 9th.
He didn't come here looking for hatred. He came here to escape it and to find freedom. He didn't come here seeking to deny other people opportunity. He came here to find it for himself, thinking that it was available to all people who lived in America. He came here believing that freedom here was freedom for everyone. George Wallace takes the position that those who have a stake in our society, those who have already made it, ought to build a wall between themselves and those who haven't made it in order to be safe and secure. Well, we in Poland knew what walls meant. Walls were built by the occupying powers for the same reason, to protect the rulers and the privileged classes, the citizens of the occupying countries, against the unrest and dissatisfactions of the occupying people. And we know what those walls represented. They represented fear and hatred and insecurity. Nobody is safe in that kind of a country. The only thing that makes a country safe is freedom for every one of its citizens. And once we begin denying it to any of our citizens, we find ourselves in trouble. Paderewski understood this. And he came here to the United States often to breathe that air of freedom, which he tried to transport back to his homeland in the brief period between the two world wars when Poland was free. He understood that this is what Poles have been fighting for 1,000 years, not only for themselves, but for others. This is why Kosciuszko came here. This is why Pulaski came here. Fight for freedom. Poles often succeed in fighting with each other. But never over this. This is always united. Against every enemy. Against insuperable odds. I've been to Poland just twice. And I'll never forget the first time. It was in 1959, in my first year at the Senate. And I had just a weekend there. I stayed in Warsaw and traveled on a Sunday west to Poznań, where the freedom fighters lie buried in the cemetery there, to the ancient capital of Gniezno, and attended mass in that ancient cathedral. And one thing I remember about that Sunday morning, as we drove from Warsaw west, first of all, the horses and the wagon, two of the most precious possessions of Poland, who've always loved their horses. They've had the best horsemen in their military forces and for peaceful purposes of any country in Europe. Going to church, all dressed up, Poles in a communist country which frowns on religion, but they were never able to kill it in those poles. Those churches on Sunday were crowded to overflowing. And the religious shrines along the road, every one of them, neat, perfectly kept, a thing of beauty. We stopped and talked to some of them. I had to do it through an interpreter, I'm sad to relate. But the pride that they took in their possessions, in their religion, in their country, shone in their eyes and in their faces. Love of freedom and all it means, whose compassion for people, and especially those who haven't had a chance, whose intelligence and spirit and pride qualify him to be a Pole. We need a man to lead us as president in the next 4 years who believes in uniting our country, not a man who believes in dividing it. We need a man who wants to chase away fear and create instead kindness and compassion. A man who wants to get Americans working together, creating trust and confidence rather than hating each other in fear and apprehension. Hubert Humphrey is that kind of a man. He's that kind of a leader. And for a quarter of a century, as mayor of Minneapolis, as a senator of the United States, as vice president, he has a record of achievement and accomplishment in this field. Let me say just a word about Mr. Nixon. Mr. Nixon was a member of Congress for 6 years. There isn't a single piece of legislation identified with his name. He was vice president for 8 years. And at the end of that time, when his president was asked what significant contribution Nixon had made to his administration, the president said, well, give me a week and I might think of something. Uh-huh. now 8 years since he made that statement, and he still hasn't told us. And during his record as a congressman and a senator and a vice president, he voted against, worked against, the very kinds of things we need to do in this country and have done for the last 8 years to make it a land of opportunity for the average American. The record is clear that from 1952 to 60, we had three recessions, which cost our country $175 billion in lost production. With what that means for the average citizen, reducing our capacity at the local, state, and federal level to build schools, to provide hospitals, to provide health care, Medicare, to clean up our environment, to perform all these services which are necessary to create a country in which individual opportunity can flourish. But since 1960, we've increased our national production by $350 billion, or almost as much as it was in 1960 after 180 years of our national history. And in that time, we've doubled our investment in schools. We've doubled our investment in hospitals. We've doubled our investment in plants, manufacturing plants, which create the jobs, which provide the opportunity. We've built a growing America in the last 8 years, an expanding America, which has made life better for each of us, and which has made it possible for America to provide opportunity for those who didn't have it before. And all we need to do is to keep on working in this same direction as we have for 180 years. And we'll build better lives for ourselves and for those who now have unacceptable lives. You create more opportunities by bringing in people into our society. That's what we've done for 180 years. That's why we're here, you and I. And by bringing people in and adding their energy, their minds and their hearts and their talents and their skill to the great pool of a free people, we've made it possible for this country to grow. And that's the way to keep it growing. Thank you. So election day is a little over 3 weeks away. We've got an uphill fight. It's going to take hard work. But I tell you, from crossing this continent 3 times in the last 5 weeks, that the people are responding. Now, whether or not they do it enough and in sufficient numbers to help us to win depends upon how much help we get. The Vice President and I have just 2 vocal cords, 2 sets, and we're using them. And you know he can use his pretty good. He's using it. But we need help. We need help to break the wall down, to break all the barriers down. So I suppose it goes back to my father. When he came here, it was an uphill fight, and he didn't stop until he won. And winning as a Democrat in Maine was an uphill fight, and I didn't stop until I won. And this is an uphill fight, and we're not going to stop until we win. And as a matter of fact, it's more fun to win those fights. I had one easy fight. It was in 1964 when I ran for re-election to the Senate. And I was ahead 2-1 when I started, and I ended up 2-1, and it was a bore. There was no satisfaction to it at all. But that first race for governor, that first race for the Senate, I'm telling you that when I won those, I felt as though I was about 9 miles tall. This one on November 5th, all of those who believe in freedom are going to be on the mountaintop. You know, I love you all so much because you're exactly what my father told me you would be. God bless.